After wishing everyone Boker Tov and thanks for coming, we're continuing our discussion of responsa, of tshuva, to questions that came up during the course of Jewish history.
I'm sorry, could you introduce yourself?
Azariah Berzel.
Okay, thank you.
And last week we spoke about family issues. We'll pick up that again today, God willing. But first I want to focus on another issue, which I think is so important, especially in contemporary Jewish life. And that is our relationship to non-observant Jews. When I say non-observant Jews, the Israelis call them chilonim. I don't like that phrase too much.
Excuse me, if you get a hold of Friday's Jerusalem Post, they had a whole article on Jewraelis. The chilonim population in Israel is completely different from that of the United States.
We'll get into that in Mitzvah Shem as we go along. But give me just a few minutes, if you don't mind, just to present my topic for today, and hopefully if we'll finish this topic within our time allotment, we'll have time to begin at least the next topic, which I want to pick up in our next meeting, which will be 2 weeks from today, because next week today is Tisha B'Av, so we're not meeting but 2 weeks from today. Rav Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of Palestine, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, he used to say that there are religious Jews and not yet religious Jews. Now, the issue of our relationship to non-observant Jews is, as you can imagine, a very important issue. And what we're going to see is, as we go through some of the sources, it would seem, you know, before we bring a heroic tshuva, you know, some sort of a revolution in the history of Torah literature, that it's an open shut case. What I mean is that the sources indicate that a Jew who violates the Torah is not part of the Jewish community. I mean, that's an understatement. So again, when we go back to the original sources, that's why I want you to give you a historical perspective here. What we used to is because we live in the post-revolution period. And at one point in history, and you'll be shocked to know who I think turned the clock around and really made the revolution, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. We're used to the fact that non-religious Jews are part of the Jewish community. They make up the majority of the Jewish community. We're lucky if the religious Jews have some representation. But the issue that we're going to talk about is counting them in a minyan. You're talking about a Machal Shabbos for Farhesia, someone who violates the Shabbos itself. The Torah considers Shabbos a capital crime. You know, this is serious business. The Torah says that we cannot consider such a person who violates the Shabbos publicly as part of our minyan. We can't trust his testimony. We cannot count him for Kriyas HaTorah. I mean, the halachas go way beyond. I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg. But if you look at classic Torah literature, as we're going to soon see, from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu and on, I mean, these people who represented the fringe of the Jewish community, they were ostracized. And again, I'm understating it, because I don't want to tell you exactly what Chazal say about such a person, because you'll be shocked. And now we live in a new period of time. A time of Kiruv, a time of all the different organizations, institutions that are trying to bring non-religious Jews closer to the fold. And we're going to have to see where that revolution begins. Now, just to give you a little bit of historical perspective, you've all heard of the Karaim. The Karaim, sometimes called the Sadducees, there are many different names for them. This was a sect of Judaism, a break-off, that rejected Torah Sheval Peh, the Oral Torah. For them, their interpretation of the written Torah was all that counted. And they became the opponents of the so-called Prushim. Those were the Jews who understood the Torah based on the transmission of Torah from Moshe Rabbeinu to Har Sinai. Moshe Rabbeinu got two Torahs, not just one. In any event, the Karaim, who came from the Tzdukim, they certainly were guilty of violating the Torah, many, many very basic precepts of the Torah. And the question is, what to do with them? So let me mention a few of the early sources to you. We start with the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah, if anybody wants pages, I photocopied for you. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah speaks about a min, an apikoris, a mumar. These are all different terminologies that relate to people who reject the Torah. And the Gemara makes the following distinction. There's someone called a mumar. He violates the Torah, lite'avon. Lite'avon means he cannot overcome his evil inclination, you know, his desire for pleasure. That's one kind of a mumar. But a more radical, more extreme type of a mumar is one who violates the Torah, lahachis. Lahachis means as a matter of rebellion. He simply rejects the Torah. So the first case is someone who accepts the Torah. He realizes that he's falling short. He claims that's it. He can't overcome the evil inclination. And he's a lowercase mumar. In other words, he's still part of the Jewish community. But once a person has an ideology, and his ideology is antithetical to the Torah, then he becomes a mumar lahachis. And the Gemara says about such a person who rebels against the Torah as an ideological principle is called a kofer. A kofer means he denies the Torah, and we're not going to save his life if he's in peril. The Gemara says we will not return a lost item if he lost it, and he's not considered part of the Jewish community. And so the sources, the early sources, and I'm just mentioning the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, but it goes throughout the Gemara in Chulin, which talks about the fact that a mumar, we can't trust him for slaughtering an animal. His shechita is nevela. We're not allowed to eat from the meat. And all this is basic in the Gemara. Then we get to the period of the Karoyim. And the one who writes about this period of time is none other than the Rambam. Which again, you'll see here on your source material. I'll just quote a few of the Rambam. See, the Rambam is all over the place, and he keeps repeating himself. But in one particular place, the Rambam really makes a bit of a revolution. I'm going to see how centuries later, the later poskim after the Rambam is 1,000 years ago. How are they going to deal with the Rambam? So the Rambam writes. And this you'll see on the pages. You know, there are three sort of sections here, so you can take one page of each section. The Rambam writes that there's somebody called a min. A min is someone who denies one God. He may worship many gods. And then he has another subcategory of a min, and that's osa vers lahachis, right? He violates the Torah out of a sense of rebellion. And then he has another category called an apikoris. I'm leading up, as soon as I get to the page that you have, because I couldn't photocopy all the pages, okay. So you'll see a page that says two on it, yeah. But we're not up to that yet, because okay. I just want to give you a little bit of the background. So the Rambam says there's another category called an apikoris, is a kofer b'torah u'b'nevuah. He denies the Torah and prophecy. And the Rambam says that these people should be put to death. Again, I'm not going to read to you all the gory words here in the Rambam, because I don't want to scare the living daylights out of you. The Rambam then goes on to qualify, and he says a Yisrael, a Jew who's committed to Torah, to mitzvot, to nevuah, he accepts the Torah, but he's a Baal Averos. The Rambam says he violates the Torah for his own pleasures. Then the Rambam says, mitzvah la'atzilo, that if he's in danger, we're obligated to save him. And the Rambam classifies him as, quote, an ochel nevelos l'teyovon, which means, look, you give him two possibilities. He's got kosher meat, he's got non-kosher meat. Same price. So he will eat the kosher meat. But if you tempt him, because you charge him half the price, and he wants to use the other half of the money for having a hopla, having a good time, that becomes a mumar ochel nevelos lehanos atzmo, for the sake of pleasure. And now you see the Rambam sort of repeats himself on page 2, in the laws of Gzeilav Aveda, and the Rambam says, ochel nevelos l'teyavon, mitzvah lahashiv avidaso. You'll see it underlined. The Rambam says we are obligated to return a lost item to someone who eats nevela, but he only does it l'teyavon. In other words, he doesn't have access to kosher meat. He shouldn't have eaten the non-kosher meat for sure, but he does so because he has to, you know, his evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara, is getting the best of him. Aval ochel nevelos lahachis. If the reason why he eats the vela, all things are equal, he can get kosher meat. But he's rebelling ideologically against the Torah, then he's called a min, he's called an apikoris, and the Rambam adds mechal Shabbos befarhesia if he violates the Torah, he violates the Shabbos publicly. Also lahachzilo aveda, he has the same status as a non-Jew because he's rebellious. He's doing it intentionally, and therefore he's out of the Jewish community. And the Rambam is going to quote this kind of halacha again and again and again. In the laws of Shechita, can we trust the Shechita? In the laws of Eidus, can we trust his testimony? In the laws of Tefillah, can we count him as a minion? And over and over and over again, the Rambam is going to say if he has an ideological rebellion against the Torah, he's not part of the Jewish community.
He was at the...
Way before. I would say approximately four centuries before.
And how would he dress the Maranos who had to outwardly be Machal Shabbos, because if they observe the Shabbat,
right,
they would end up...
So, excellent. So, that's what I want to get to. Again, I need a few minutes.
Yeah,
just a few minutes to create a structure. You know, then we can plug in the details. What's the structure? So, the real breakthrough in the Rambam is in the middle of your page 2, and that's Hilchos Mamrim. Mamrim is another word for those who are rebellious. And the Rambam says that, number one, someone who denies Torah, even if it's only Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, and then he says that person is considered a min. And what do we do with such a person? Moridin v'lo malim. Basically, it means we could cause his death. And the Rambam includes under this category individuals who are apikorsim, that claim that there's no Torah that was given from Shamayim. And the Rambam says, Eino b'chlal Yisrael, he's not considered like a Jew. And the Rambam even recommends putting a person like that to death. Again, very, very extreme position here, but the Rambam is not at fault. He's really just codifying the original sources. Oh, now the Rambam goes on to qualify the whole business. And that's why this particular Rambam is the most important, perhaps, of all the Rambams that we have. Bamedvar Mamurim, says the Rambam, I'm going to translate this into English. When do we assume that such a rebellious Jew who denies the Torah is out of the fold? That's only Isha Kofar B'Torah Shebaal Peh. He denies Torah Shebaal Peh. Why? Mimach Shavto, because he's come to that conclusion. Dvarim Shenirim Lo. Now, he weighed the possibilities, and this was his commitment ideologically. V'holech Achar Daito Akala. He decides to go with his light kind of understanding, Akashriris Libo, Kofar B'Toshbe, he denies the Torah. Aval Osam, B'nei Osam HaToim. What about the children of those who broke away from the Torah on an ideological basis? U B'neiim, and how much more so their grandchildren? Shehidichu Osam Avosam, that their fathers or grandfathers have swayed them in the wrong direction. Vinoldu, and from childhood, they were born into Minus, into this denial. Vigadlu Osam Olav, they were grown, they were raised on these false beliefs. And here's the revolution. Harehen Kitinok Shenishva. They are like a child, a Jewish child who's taken nishba, who's taken captivity, and he was raised amongst the non-Jews. Again, the Rambam's not talking about a person who was baptized at birth and raised as a Christian. The Rambam is talking about a person whose parents are Jewish, whose grandparents are Jewish. He's Jewish, but his parents and grandparents raised him, if you will, poisoned his mind. I'm adding that to the Rambam. And he was totally brainwashed. And he was brought up just like a child who was brought up in a Christian monastery, as far as these false beliefs are concerned, denial of Torah. Says the Rambam, Tinok Shenishba, a child who was taken captivity at birth? is anus. Oh, that's a great word. Anus. Let me write that word on the blackboard here, the whiteboard, as they call it. Okay. So Tinok Shenishba is taken into captivity, right? As a child, and now we have anus. Right? What does anus mean? Anus means he was coerced. Right? He was forced. In other words, beyond his control. The most extreme case in the Torah of anus is in Parashas Ki Tetzeh and Sefer Dvarim. That's a raped woman who's not in any way responsible for the action because she was coerced. That's called an anus. The Rambam writes that the children and the grandchildren of those who made the decision to deviate, rebel, and reject the Torah, those children and grandchildren are called anus. But what happens when the child grows up, and now we're getting closer to our contemporary society, and he becomes exposed to Jewish people? Says the Rambam, V'afal pisha shama achar kach shehu Yehudi, he heard that he's a Jew, v'ra Yehudim v'dosam, and he observes the Jews and their religious behavior, he sees how they observe the Torah, hareyu kanus, nevertheless, he's still an anus, the Rambam says. He hasn't lost his status as an anus. Why? Sharei gidluhu al ta'usam, because even though he's seen the Jews, he's already been poisoned the way he was raised up. And therefore, says the Rambam, what's our relationship to such a Jew, the second generation, the third generation? Lefichach roi lahachzir l'tshuva. We should do whatever we can to bring them back to do tshuva. V'limshoch osam b'darkei shalom. And other Rishonim say that not only b'darkei shalom, not only should we try to bring them back to tshuva with peaceful methods, but we should even give them avon, even give them love, ad sheyachzeru li'eisan haTorah, till they come back to the strength of the Torah. And therefore, we're not going to do to them what we do to a min, to an apikoris, to anyone who denies the Torah, like the ochel nevelos lahachis. So I got excited about this Rambam because I was thinking of a situation that was coexistent to the Rambam. At the Rambam's time, there were karoim, and they were generations and generations from the original Tzdukim and Vaitusim who denied Torah Shebaal Peh. And I have no doubt that these are the people that the Rambam has in mind. And if the Rambam is to be taken at face value, the Rambam is telling us that these children, ever who were raised on these ideologies and these beliefs, are not to be held responsible. On the contrary, our relationship to them should be to bring them back to tshuva. And their status is that of a tinok shenishba and an anus. So I was very excited about this until I saw the Radbaz. The Radbaz is on the right side. He's the super commentary on the Rambam. And the Radbaz, his name is Rabbi David Ibn Zimra. He lived in Egypt, let's call it the 1400s, spilling a little bit into the 1500s. He was pretty much a contemporary of Rav Yosef Cairo, an older contemporary. The Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch. And he writes, again, I'm not going to go through the entire piece inside. I'm just going to read to you the main point of the Radbaz. The Radbaz says, "Hanimtzoyim bizmanenu." Whatever the Rambam wrote is about is appropriate for the Rambam's period of time. But those karoim that we find in our time, he says, "Im haya efshar biyadenu lo ridam mitzvah lo ridam," we should get rid of them. If we only had the possibility of doing so. Sherei b'chol yom anu machzirin osam lemutav. On a daily basis, we try so hard to bring them back. U'moshchim osam, and we try to allure them in, so to speak, attract them in. Lahamin b'torah shebaal peh, to believe Torah shebaal peh. And nevertheless, you know what response we get from them after we do this on a daily basis? Hey mecharfim u'megadfim. They go ahead and they ridicule and they even curse with blasphemous words the Balei Kabbalah, the transmission of the Torah. V'ein ladun es elu b'chlal anusim. And these are not considered anusim. You remember circumstances beyond your control. They were coerced. Why? Because we gave them every opportunity. We tried very hard. We extended our right hand to try to be makari of them. And they still refused to listen. And then he writes, he thinks that the Rambam was also only trying to be melamed zchus. Now that's an interesting concept, melamed zchus. I'll write that on the board. Melamed zchus means, you know, sometimes situations are very extreme and you want to try to find some sort of excuse or merit for someone who violates the Torah.
Giving the benefit of the doubt.
Sure. Go beyond the benefit of the doubt. Even when you really doubt the doubt, but give them the benefit of the doubt. Now the Radbaz has a tremendous impact on Jewish history, and for centuries, until modern times, this was the approach of the poskim, that the Karoim and others who denied Torah have been given ample opportunity. We've tried time and time again to be makariv them, and they refuse. They continue in their blasphemy. And therefore the category of the Rambam called Tinok Shenishba, which allows us to encompass and embrace these Jews as part of the Jewish community, no longer applies. And that's the Radbaz 5 centuries ago. But as I told you at the outset, there's a history of responsa, which I call heroic revolutionary. And you're probably not going to guess who is the one living in the 20th century who changed things around. You may be able to guess it because I gave it to you on the photocopy pages.
It's either the Chazon Ish or the Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Yeah, it's the Chazon Ish. It's unbelievable, the Chazon Ish. You know, the Chazon Ish is classically presented or projected in the world of Torah and Psak as the great Machmir. You know, he's the one who always takes the strict opinion. But I want to learn with you his description of the concept of Tinok Shenishba as it applies in our time. So you'll see, again, I couldn't photocopy all these pages for you, but you'll see on page 5 the Chazon Ish. You have such a thing? He says the following. And where is this Chazon Ish? It's the very beginning, the introduction to the laws of Shechita. Who's kosher for Shechita? Only someone who believes in the Torah. And therefore, someone who's not religious and it's not observant, and worse than that, he violates the Torah, he desecrates the Shabbos publicly, is certainly out as far as Shechita is concerned. Says the Chazon Ish, Tinok Shenishba Bein Ha'akum, Dino Ki Yisrael, Shechitosu Muteres. A Jewish child who is raised in a non-Jewish environment is a Tinok Shenishba. He was captured. He was forced upon him. And therefore we could eat from his shechita. But then the Chazon Ish, without mentioning the Radbaz, addresses the issue of the Radbaz, but we tried over and over again to influence this person. And guess what? He still refuses. He says, Shehu Bechezkas, now we have to underline that word, Bechezkas, She'im yodi'u v'yishtadlu imo kishir yishtadlu shuroi loshev lo yazid levilti shav. The chazoka means the assumption, says the Chazon Ish, is if we'll notify him and we'll work with him as much as we have to up until a certain point, that he'll be able to do tshuva, meaning we'll counterbalance all the negative influences, then in such a case, we have reason to believe that he will not continue to deliberately violate the Torah. Amnam, however, we're not totally out of the clear. Achash ishtadlu imo, if we worked with him as much as necessary, v'humezen, and nevertheless he continues in his evil ways, umemayin losh, if he refuses to do tshuva, then dino kimumar. Okay, So the Chazon Ish has introduced a brand new concept into the world of halacha, which has so much relevance. And that's called Kishir HaEshtadlus Shuroi Loshim. What's Kishir HaEshtadlus? At what point do you say, well, I did enough with him? I offered him all the philosophical discussions. I sent him to this organization, to that organization. He heard this lecture, he heard that lecture. We invited him for a Shabbos meal. We had everything you want. And still, nothing. You know, we can't penetrate into his heart. He insists that he continues to be a violator of the Torah. What is that Shir Ishtadlus? Can you give it to me on paper? Can you give me a syllabus? Give me an amount of courses, of lectures, of shiurim that he has to hear. Objectify it. Says the Chazon Ish, v'shir ha'ishtadlus tolui lefi hisbonenus hadayonim. Now I'm going to try to explain that phrase according to the best of my ability, and you're all free to disagree with me. But I think what he's saying is that there is no objective shiur of ishtadlus. How much do we have to work with him? And it's going to be subjective, and it's going to be decided by the dayan and by the judges. The judges will decide in every single case where this, you know, Avram, Yitzchak, or Yaakov, and I use those names deliberately because they are the Bnei Avos, whether they had enough of exposure to a Kiruv project that they should have done tshuva, and they insisted on not doing tshuva. Well, let me ask you a question. Who are these dayanim? Who are these judges that are going to make that judgment call? So look at the next phrase in the Chazon Ish. Kasher yofia beruach kodshom be'achroas dino. The Chazon Ish acknowledges that it's not your run-of-the-mill judge. You know, we're not talking about getting three judges together to decide a monetary case or something of that sort. Because we're dealing with a life-and-death situation. We're dealing with posketing whether or not this fellow is Jewish or not Jewish. Which means that if he's not Jewish, boom. You know, if we had the power to do so, we'd snuff him out, so to speak. We're dealing with life and death. So the Chazon Ish, coins a new phrase over here. And he says, Beruach Kodshon. We need Ruach HaKodesh. Now Chazal say there are three levels of judges. There's the basic court that's made up of three judges. Then we get up to the higher court, which is called Sanhedrin Ketana, that's made up of 23 judges, until we get to the highest court of Israel, which is made up of 70 plus one judges. The plus one is the Nasi who presides over the... So you're talking about 71 judges. That's the high court of Israel. They have Ruach HaKodesh. They will determine all the laws. They will rule on all issues. They will even formulate the Nusach of Brachos and Tfilos. That's the high court of Israel. They'll determine the Chodesh, but moreover they'll determine Ibur HaShana, whether we add another month to the year, and so forth and so on. They will judge a Kohen Gadol and a Melech. That's the highest court of Israel. They have Ruach HaKodesh. It seems to me, again this is Berzon, that Chazon Ish is saying that in order to judge a so-called non-religious Jew and decide whether he's a min and apikoris or whether he's a tinok shenishba, we would require in each and every one, every individual case, a bezin of the highest court in the land to make that judgment call and see if we can determine that this person who's standing in front of us had been exposed to the shir ishtadlus, that he should have accepted the Torah. But he refused to do it. How can you even imagine such a situation? And therefore, I think the Chazon Ish is going to paskin that our average non-religious Jew fits the category of a chazaka. Chazaka means that if we could have gotten to the point where he was exposed, kishir ashtaglus, the amount of kiruv that he needs, he would have done tshuva. That's going to be the chazaka. That's going to be our assumption. And he says the following, Ubi MS, I'm fast forwarding a little bit because it's a very long piece. Tzarech ladun al kol ish vi ish befrat. There's no general decision on this. You know, you can't say, well, there's a group of irreligious Jews and we gave them a lecture, we gave them two lectures or three lectures, and we organized the Shabbos and a Tiyul and everything else for them, and we're going to paskin on the whole group. No! Every individual needs his own decision. And basically, the reason for this is because Tinok Shenishba, just like the case of Karoim, who were raised with that belief, with that ideology that's antithetical to Torah, so to the non-religious Jews of our time, says the Chazon Ish, were raised with this ideological poison, so to speak. And by the way, just a comment of my own, a lot of that poison comes from the press. And I served in the Israeli army as a lecturer. That was my job in the army, after they saw how great of a sharpshooter I was, because I was conscripted at the age of 34 to the army. So for the next 13 years, I was lecturing in the army, and they gave me the honor and the dignity to lecture on religious topics, and it was nearly impossible to get a non-religious Jew to show up unless he was a Sfaradi, because the Sfaradim have tradition. You know, they might not be totally observant, but they had a respect. And there were many occasions, especially in one particular base where I lectured on a regular basis, that none of the Chayalim would leave the room until I left the room. And many of them would kiss my hands. And these were Chayalim, these were soldiers who put on a kippah on their head just to hear the lecture. But they were all Sfaradim. And I hate to say it, but with the Ashkenazim, it's mamish, this Tinoch Shenishva mentality, this is the ideology, and religion is antiquated, and our ideology is antithetical. He says that Osan shall avos pirshu midarkei atzibur v'nis gadol glulot Torah, those whose forefathers had left the fold and they were raised on that philosophy, dino ki Yisrael chaldova. Until we can prove that they had the shir ishtadlus that we spoke about, then we assume that they have a status of a Jew. And therefore the law of Moridim, that normally we as I said before, we snuff out someone who's an apikoros, who's a min, who's a ochel neilis lahachis, doesn't apply. And take a look at the paragraph on the top left. He says, v'nira di'ein din Moridim. He says that the din of Moridim, that we should put away, snuff out the life of someone who's the apikoros and so forth, that's only at a special time in Jewish history when God has revealed His miraculous hashgacha nisit. Nisit means above the natural law. And tzaddiki ador hashgacha pratis. And there's a special divine providence and supervision during those very unique periods of time when the judges will be endowed with ruach hakodesh, this special insight. Then there'll be a mitzvah called bir harishayim, and we'll have to get rid of the evil too. He says, in our time, ha'helem, he says, we live in a time of the absence of faith, because it's very, God is playing hide and seek, so to speak. He's not revealed Himself. There are no supernatural events. He says, then, ein b'masa horada, this idea of putting him away, that's not going to help us anymore. Adarab, it's going to push them further and further aside, and therefore those dinim that we saw do no longer apply today. This, my friends, is a radical breakthrough. The poskim, yeah, go ahead.
So, I guess Rav Kook also was a posek, among other things, and he clearly treated anti-religious Jews even as being part of the fold. Is that not considered a breakthrough because of the fact that you didn't have credibility with the Haredi camp? Is that why you're not?
I'm not saying that Rav Kook is less of a hero than the Chazon Ish, but the Chazon Ish is heroic because Rav Kook and his position was not right. Necessarily accepted, meaning the average Jew couldn't really understand Rav Kook. Even to this day, we're still racking our brains to try to figure out Rav Kook. But when the Chazon Ish writes this, it's got an amazing impact. For example, there's a Dayan in Tel Aviv, in the Beit Din of the Rabbanut of Tel Aviv. His name is Rav Avram Sherman. And he writes an entire article, which is published in Tchumin, I don't know if you're familiar with Tchumin, on our relationship to non-religious Jews. And he bases himself to a large extent on this tshuva of the Chazon Ish. Rav Kook lived this philosophy, so to speak, but the Chazon Ish formulated it. The Chazon Ish gave us three principles here that are brand new. Principle number one is that in order to determine whether the Jew is a Tino Chenishma, we would need what's called a Shir Hishtadlus. Number two, a second breakthrough, is he tells us that in order to determine whether the Shir Hishtadlus has been fulfilled, and he insists, he's adamant about being non-religious, we would need for that a Bezdin, and not just a regular Bezdin, but we would need a Bezdin of Ruach HaKodesh, which I think is the high court of the land, that I'm adding to the Chasanish. And
not the current high court.
I mean the high court of 71 judges.
Right.
And number three, says the Chazon Ish, in our time, when we don't have Hashkacha Nisit, we're not living in a time where we can apply these rules of Morid and Vein Milin, says the Chazon Ish, we would need the Bezdin to make a determination and evaluation for each individual. And otherwise, and here's the real breakthrough of the Chazon Ish, we have a Chazaka, and he's part of Klal Yisrael.
To what extent can you drink the wine that he pours? Can
The Chazon Ish doesn't have. He says shchitas muteres. I mean, that's pretty heavy.
I assume it's because he's got a shomer though with him though. Because I think even Rambam says you have to have a shomer.
It's possible. Okay, I'm not here to paskin on hilchos shchita.
He lived in Europe.
Well, he was born in Europe, but he lived in White Russia. But he was here in Bnei Brak for a half a century.
No,
I don't think he ever showed up in the United States.
People,
no. I don't think he left Israel once he settled there, as far as I know.
There's a group of people who are Mechala Shabbos because they had to be Mechala Shabbos because of financial services.
Interesting. Fascinating question. If you don't come in Saturday, don't come in Sunday. Where are those Jews
fit in? My father was able to be in Baal Tzvila on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, even though he was Mechala Shabbos. And I was thinking, did my parents even have kosher Eidim? Because a great percentage of people in the United States in the 20s, 30s, and 40s were Mechala Shabbos because they didn't show up.
I would like to believe that the Rav who was Masada Kedusha,
the Rav I'm sure was kosher,
and possibly he was one aid, and possibly the Chazan or the Shamish of the Shul. Like, for example, my father was a Rav in Flappish. Today, Flappish is a devoutly religious neighborhood. But not the Flappish that I was brought up in, if you're familiar with Brooklyn and Flappish. I mean, you can count the observant Jews on one hand. But they were all Tinoch Shanishma. I mean, they all loved Torah, and they had other choices to go to conservative and reform. But they wanted to be part of an Orthodox community. Here's where I want to add another piece to the puzzle. You've all heard of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Now, I had a page in which Rav Usher Weiss quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I don't know where the page got lost, but if you'll be here in 2 weeks' time, I'll bring it to you. And Rav Shlomo Zalman addresses the real classic issue of Kiruv today, which is inviting non-religious Jews for a Shabbos meal, knowing full well that they're going to drive a car. So let me just point out to you what the issue is, because I always want to show you how the tshuva is revolutionary. In classic understanding of halacha, when the Torah says lifnei iver, etc., which means in front of a blind person you don't put a stumbling block, that's Torah shebichsav. In Torah shebalpeh, it means that I cannot facilitate someone's violation of the Torah. So the case in the Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah is the Nazir, who's not allowed to drink wine, and I bring him a cup of wine. So by bringing him a cup of wine, I've in effect put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. I've made it possible for him to violate the Torah. Now again, there's no question that the Nazir, insofar as he deliberately violated the Torah, he's liable for drinking the wine. But the person who gave him the wine, he is the one who set up the violation for someone else to violate. So if Reuven sets up a violation and Shimon violates it, then Reuven is in violation, although not of the prohibition itself, namely drinking the wine is a nazir. Reuven's not a nazir, but of lifnei iver. So Rav Shlomo Zalman raises the following question. If I invite a non-religious Jew to my Shabbos table, knowing full well, he says, look, there are many solutions here. You can invite him to sleep over in your house, and you have to be genuine about that. or you can tell them to come before Shabbos. You know, you try to do whatever is possible. But if at the end of the day, and all things are equal, you know he's going to violate the Shabbos, is that a violation of Lifnei Iver? And many of the poskim at that time in history, I'm going back 25 years ago, were absolutely opposed to inviting a non-religious Jew to your Shabbos table if you know he's going to. Comes along Reb Shlomo Zalman with an insight. And he says the following. The Gemara differentiates between what's called Chad Ibra Dinara and Trey Ibra Dinara, which means, are they on one side of the river or they are on two sides of the river? And the Gemara says the following, that if they ever applies when they're on two sides of a river, that's called Trey Ibra Dinara in the Lashon HaShas, which means that the Nazir has no access to the wine because he doesn't have a boat to cross the river. There's no raft. And you're going to cross the river and give him the wine. It means that in the case of Chad Ibra Dinara, where they're both on the same side of the river, and therefore the Nazir inevitably will drink the wine if he's so inclined and violate the Isur Nazirus, whether or not you give him the wine, because he has access to the wine. Again, the Gemara is giving this, you know, if you're familiar with the style of the Shas, the Gemara gives this abstract case of two sides of a river, but it's real. That's just one case in point. If you understand the concept is, would he have violated that Avera in any event?
Was
or you made it possible.
Readily accessible.
Correct. Well, we'll get to that in just a minute. That's going to be my next discussion about readily accessible. But right now, let's talk about the following. Would he have drunk the wine in any event, whether you give him the wine or not? Says Reb Shlomo Zalman, well, you know what? If you don't invite him for a Shabbos meal, then he's going to violate the Shabbos anyway. He doesn't need you to invite him to violate the Shabbos. He may go to the local pizza store, you know, or whatever, the hamburger store, the joint that's open on Friday night, he'll drive there anyway. So don't tell me that this is a case of Trey Ibra Dinara, that by inviting him for Shabbos, you made it possible and facilitated his violation of Shabbos. He knows darn well how to violate the Shabbos, pardon the French. But then Reb Shlomo Zalman asks him the following question. The Gemara says that in addition to the Doraisa, the Torah prohibition of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Mikshel, there's a rabbinic prohibition, and that's called Misayea Le'ovre Averu. Which means that Enochim, we're really both on the same side of the river. But I make it easier for him, more accessible for him, as you called it, to violate the Issa. That's Osir Midrabbanan. That's a rabbinic enactment that's called a siag, a fence around the Torah, because if we're going to allow you to give him the wine, even though he's on the same side of the river, then tomorrow you might bring the wine to him. In other words, there's a fuzzy kind of distinction here that is not always crystal clear. In order to avoid any lack of clarity, what we need is that you're not helping him at all. No aid offered for those who want to violate the Torah. That's a rabbinic issue. So comes along with Shlomo Zalman, he says the following. It may be very true that at some point he's going to violate the Shabbos, but the very moment you pinpoint a moment in time by inviting him and saying to him, well, come to my house at that hour, then you are a misayel over him. You're helping him out because you're telling him, well, the food is in my house. You know what I mean? My wife has cooked up an entire meal. So here, Reb Shlomo Zalman has to make a little bit of a revolution in order to understand why you'd be allowed to invite a person to your house on a Friday night knowing that he's going to violate the Shabbos. Now, in order to appreciate his breakthrough, I want to address a different question which Reb Shlomo Zalman again addresses, and that's the question of giving food to a non-religious Jew who's going to eat the food without a bracha. Forget about a yarmulke. You know, we'll pop a yarmulke over his head. He's a guest in your house. He knows you're religious. He'll pop on a yarmulke. You know, you've seen it at the Kotel and the Bar Mitzvah yarmulkes and all that. But he's not going to make a bracha. So here, Reb Shlomo Zalman is faced with the problem of forgetting about Chil Shabbos. This problem is going to apply the whole week long. because if you invite him even for a Tuesday night meal, he's not going to make a bruch. And he quotes the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon is absolutely strict and very severe against someone who eats without a bracha. The Gemara says, "Hanenim and olam esev lo bracha kilu mal." And the Torah says, if you don't make a bracha on your food, that's a very serious violation. So Rav Shlomo Zalman says the following: Misayela ofrei avera. If I help you violate an avera, what we have to consider is the overall picture. We're not going to focus on this particular moment in time, but we're going to ask what would be the repercussions of the absence of your action. So, for example, if I don't give him food, again, this is you can either accept this or not. I'm just telling you what Rav Shlomo Zalman thought. Then this person is going to violate a more serious violation than eating without food, and that's called lotisna sachicha bilvavecha. Why? Because if you invite a person to your house and then you tell them, "Well, don't eat," that's going to generate a certain feeling that he harbors a resentment against you, and that resentment, if it festers, is going to amount to a violation of hatred, of lotisna sachicha bilvavecha, which is an appropriate topic for this time of the year as we're in the 9 days. So he says the following: you're in a choice situation. You either facilitate his making his eating without a bracha, or you might get into a situation where you marchik him, you push him so far away that he ends up violating lotisna sachicha bilvavecha, of hatred. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman that in this case, again, keep in mind that Misael over here is only Rabbanon, it's only rabbinic enactment. The Rabbanon would not enact a situation in which you are inhibited, you're enjoined from helping him, if your intention is to help him to reduce the amount of averis that he's going to do. And again, the floor is yours. Just a second, I want to point out that the Gemara has a svara like this at the end of Yuma, which is very important for Shlomo Zalman. The Gemara says that we violate the Shabbos for someone who's sick because ultimately he will observe more Shabbosos and will sacrifice one Shabbos for the sake of the overall picture. Good.
So, but if you analyze the case of inviting somebody over, there's sort of a different way to look at it. On the one hand, if you don't invite them over at all, you're not going to be Marva Sino because it's like, you know, on the other hand, if you do invite them over,
and then
you're Marva
Ava.
But then once they're there, so in other words, just the way that you describe Rav Shlomo Zalman looking at it is, what is the impact of having them over and then not giving them? But what about the memela you're going to have to give them?
Right.
But what about the
invitation itself?
The fact of the invitation itself, which is Marba Ahava, maybe makes them realize that we're not boogeymen,
right.
And maybe, you know.
So those are the two paragraphs. So the first paragraph is Rav Asher Zelig Weiss. Mm-hmm. When he quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman, he says, okay, he's there, he expects a meal, and now you're gonna insult him, so to speak, by telling him he can't eat because he doesn't know how to make a bracha. Again, if we'll make the bracha, that's great. But who told you to invite him to begin with? So here's where, as you say very well, Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying that if we look at the overall picture, what's going to be, how much Chil Shabbos is he going to violate over the course of his life if no one reaches out to him and tries to make an impression on him? So the kiruv and the invitation and the warmth that you give him is a chance that maybe, perhaps, ultimately, he will observe more Shabbosos, and instead of looking at it as if you're being Misayel over Avera, because you're setting it up that he, so again, as far as Lifnei Avera, Reb Shlomo Zalman says he's going to violate the Shabbos in any event. But as far as increasing, you know, the different kinds of Isurim, he says, let's look at the overall picture. Okay, this is one.
Excuse me, can I call something?
Yeah, please.
I walked into my friend's house, and the son of a very chashuv Rosh Yeshiva is sitting on the couch drinking beer without a yarmulke. Now, obviously, he was drinking beer because it's the 9 days. He knew enough not to be drinking wine. Are we obligated? I mean, I felt bad. I didn't know whether to say to her, give him a yarmulke, whether I should... You know, what is our position? We're not talking about people who don't. This is a son of a chashuv of Rosh Yeshiva.
You know, every case has to be judged in its own. I would think, you know, that's my gut feeling, if you ask me, that in that case, you know, non-involvement would be the best policy. You know, leave it to the Rosh Yeshiva. You have no clue what the dynamics are behind the scenes. I wouldn't get involved in that case. I mean, that's really
heavy. The hostess doesn't have to offer him a yarmulke.
That's a different question. That, I think, you know, she should have thought this out beforehand. Maybe she wasn't aware of it, but if things would have been ideal, she would have figured out what she's getting into here by calling up his parents or
this is an adult, 20-some-odd-year-old young man.
But I'm saying, I don't know, again, there's so many variables here that I can't figure out. I would think that, you know, in such a case, she should be prepared up front. Maybe she'd have, you know, put yarmulkes on the side and see whether he decides to take advantage of them. You have to be very, very sensitive.
With a new population nowadays.
We have to write a whole new psychology book on how to deal. The main issue is dignity, what we call kavod abrios, and at the same, you know, it says about Hillel, that he was oeves abrios and makarvon l'Torah. He was oeves abrios. You know, if you have the ava and you realize that this person is a birya, the Baal Tanya says a birya means he's on a basic level. He doesn't know much, or for whatever reason he may have rejected what he was taught. You have to. You know. So again, since again we're limited in time, I'm going to take questions a little bit later if you don't mind. I just want to finish one topic. I gave you out a page that says Shut Igros Moshe on it. Do you have such a page for those who like to follow a text inside? I never know what your preference might be. And I want to introduce a very, very important topic again in contemporary life. And I think the breakthrough tshuva is here in Rav Moshe Feinstein. And I'll write the topic, the name of the topic in Hebrew is called Hazra'ah Melachutit. And in English, it's called artificial insemination. Now, the first one to really write a major tshuva on this topic, to the best of my knowledge, was Rav Moshe Feinstein. And I'm going to go through parts of the tshuva. We won't be able to finish it. And I'm going to translate as I go along. We're talking about a case of a rabbi who asks Rav Moshe Feinstein many, many different questions about the same scenario. And the scenario is, and we'll see a lot more as we read the tshuva, so right now we don't know too much about it, was that this woman was given a donation of sperm from another man other than her husband. In other words, she's married, a Jewish woman married to a Jewish man, and the physician injected sperm from another man, a donor, into her body, and as a result she became pregnant and she had a baby. And the question that was asked, again there are many, many different dimensions to this question, we'll talk about the most revolutionary or the most profound issue, is whether or not she could continue in a marriage relationship with her husband. Now, to you and I, it might not sound so revolutionary, but trust me, in its time, this was a major, major breakthrough. And anyone who knows beans about Rav Moshe and his tshuvas will know that he was a very original thinker. He was not, he didn't mince words. You know, and this tshuva generates about five other tshuvas, because between each and every tshuva, somebody else writes a counter-argument against him, and he has to defend himself. But this is the original, right here. Chelek Aleph of Ebenezer Simon Yud. He says, let's go through some of the details and the background of this situation. The couple was childless for 10 years since the date of their marriage. And the physicians say that this is not a judgment call, but on a physiological level, the problem was with the husband. The husband simply was not capable of making his wife pregnant. She desperately wanted to have a child. And Rav Moshe goes on to say that this feeling of a woman wanting to have a child is absolutely natural. Kiratzon kol anashim, he calls it, it's the will of all ladies, of all women. And to prove that point, he quotes a Gemara in Yevamos, and the Gemara says the following, that even though a woman is not obligated according to Torah law in the bits of period of a rivi, she doesn't have to have children, nevertheless, if her husband refuses, within the context of marriage, to have a child, it's from her perspective, she has rights for divorce. And that's called kofin habal legarsha. There's an entire sugi in the Gemara in Yevamos. What are the conditions necessary for her to force her husband to give her a get and to pay the ksuba? And the Gemara talks about a case that he's the one who is preventing her from getting married, his husband, the husband. And therefore, she has rights to demand a divorce. So Rav Moshe opens up his tshuva by, in a sense, empathizing with this woman and emphasizing to what extent she is in the right in demanding that they have children. Again, he's not, you know, he's not capable of having children. So we have a very odd situation. It's not that he's refusing deliberately to have children, but they simply tried and tried, and the medical professionals decided that he cannot have children. And this situation, says Rav Moshe, in terms of the sugya Yevamos, would be grounds for divorce. He says the following: Ubeloze yadua gami umos. If we go back to our mothers, Rachel, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, we will find Ratzalaholid, they had a natural desire to give birth, to be mothers of children. She went to the Rofe out of desperation, and we'll soon see that she did not have the permission of her husband, and the Rofe gave her this donation. Vinishal Milas Kvodo, and now your honor, meaning Rav Baruch Gross, is asking the question whether she's allowed to remain married to her husband. And furthermore, what's the status of the child? Does anybody know what word here is relevant when you say what's the status of the child? What could be the status of the child in the worst case scenario?
Worst case, Mamzer.
Mamzer, exactly, because his father is not his father, meaning the father of the marriage, which is the halachic father, should be the halachic father, is not the biological father. Says Rav Moshe, this is one of the most famous lines in the history of modern tshuva literature. Barur, he says, Shebelo bias ish, lo nesra ish alabayla. That without a sexual relationship with another man, there is no prohibition against, you know, enjoining her from continuing her marriage relationship. And the Issa Sota Labayla, Sota means a woman who had an adulterous relationship and no longer is allowed to live with her husband. Rak mitzad Issa Adbiya. It's not because she has someone else's sperm in her body, but because she had an intimate relationship with another man outside of the framework of marriage. Lo mitzad Azera Shal Ishaka. Don't think that the fact that she has another man's sperm in her body and she's a married woman, that itself would engender the Issur Sota Labayla, the prohibition against her resuming a relationship with her husband. And he says the following, that I'll prove it to you. He says we have something called Bia Shalo Kedarka. That means if a woman has an intercourse, which is not a normal intercourse, it's anal intercourse with another man, she can no longer resume her marriage with her husband. That's called a sota. In other words, the relationship to sota has nothing to do with the zera, because we're talking about a case where it's impossible for her to receive any of the zera in her womb. Nevertheless, she's Asur al-Baila, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. The reason for that is because the Israel al-Baila is generated by Bia. And the Torah defines this as an act of bia. But the fact that she has zera in her body, that doesn't make her into a sota. And here Rav Moshe quotes, you know, you wonder sometimes to what extent does the halacha, as it's developed back in the time of Chazal, the time of the Gemara, does it, in a sense, anticipate, you know, modern technological advances? You know, today we talk about artificial insemination and different types of you know, creating conception outside the body and test tubes and so forth and so on. To what extent did Chazal have an idea? You know, this seems so futuristic. So that's a sugya about Yanai, that Yanai's mother went into a bath of hot water, and a man, other than her husband, had taken a bath in that same spa, I guess you'd call it, and as a result, she became pregnant from the sperm of another man. And the Gemara tells us that she's not prohibited to resume her relation with her husband. And this is sort of like artificial insemination, in the sense that there was insemination and pregnancy and birth without a maisa bia. Now, if you'll ask me what's the status of the Vlad, which Rav Moshe addresses in the next paragraph, we'll have to stop here. He says the Vlad is kosher. Why? Because mamzerus depends upon bia. If a woman has an illicit relationship of bia, then the child that's born to that relationship is a mamzer under certain circumstances. And he says the following: it could be that mamzerus has nothing to do with the violation of the iser bia. And there's a case in the Gemara of Nachrim Shidbiku Zebazeh, that the Goyim actually took a Jewish man who was not her wife and forced him on top of this married woman, and they had a sexual relationship. The child of that relationship is called a mamzer. Why? Because that's considered derech bia. It was a result of a sexual relationship. Has nothing to do with the judgment call for the violation of the isur. It's all dependent upon whether or not there was a bia. Mikolakom zeu derech bia. The reason why mamzerus is achieved in that case is clinched in that case is because it was derech bia, it was through a sexual relationship. Avol benis avra yidei shenichnas hazer shalach b'meyo babati shenizko gemara. If the zera of another man goes into her body as a result of the fact that she bathed in a bath, is then kahad the osim refuim bismanena, which is similar to what the medical profession is capable of doing today, then the child is not a mamzer. Vafilu, even if that zera would come from one of her close relatives, could you imagine she became pregnant with the sperm of her own father or father-in-law, one of her brothers? And Ben Siro, I told you, was born as a result of this Ambati situation. He was born from the zera of one of his close relatives, and yet the Gemara says that he's not a mamzer. Why? Because there was no bia, there was no sexual relationship. Okay, so this is just an introduction to our discussion for next week, and we're going to soon see that Rav Moshe in his position really was attacked, and I don't know if you know the history. They tried to excommunicate him in certain circles. Today we're so familiar with Rav Moshe's breakthrough, but you're going to see why there was so much opposition.
Was this another one that Rav Hankin opposed?
No, I don't think that Rav Hankin took a stand on this issue. I just want to.
This excludes rape. That's another issue which I hope you bring up next week.
Yeah, I'm saying rape was the case that I mentioned before about Shedovkum Nochrim Zeba Zeh. And in such a case, if the Boel, if the person who had the relationship, again through no decision of his own, was forced on her, and he was a Jewish man, then the child would be a mamzer in that case. Because again, it's because of a sexual relationship.
So if she's raped by a Jewish man, the kid is a mamzer anyway?
Correct. If she's a married woman.
So she better hope that it's not a...
Yeah, she'll be better off if it happens to be a non-Jew. Now, if it's a... That's going to be this tshuva. That's where Moshe is going to... We don't know where the sperm came from. And that's going to be an issue of kahuna, of yuchsin. Can the child, if it's a girl, marry a Kohen, not marry a Kohen? a very revolutionary position of Rav Moshe. Now the things I'd like to cover, because I'm not sure how many more meetings we have, is another breakthrough tshuva, the Chazon Ish, about the city of Paris, whether there's an Erev, a natural Erev in the city of Paris. The issue of chashmal, of electricity, whether electricity is considered fire or not. There we'll have a tshuva of, the Rav of Vilna, Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski. I want to talk to you about Torah for Noshim, for women. And now here I want to share something from my Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. And I want to talk to you about Rav Moshe's tshuva about reform marriages. Okay, so these are some of the topics that I have in mind for heroic response over Jewish history. I want to thank you all and wish you a meaningful 3 weeks, which we're more than halfway through the 3 weeks, and a meaningful Tisha B'Av. We should be zochet to see the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash b'mehirah v'yameinu.
When was your father, Rabbi?
On the Yom Yisrael of